At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce our guest lecturer for tonight, Mr. William Robinson III. He completed his undergraduate studies at Thomas More College, later attended law school at the University of Kentucky. He's currently the head of Frost Brown Todd law firm, the head member of the Northern Kentucky branch. If you haven't heard of them, Frost Brown Todd is one of the area's leading law firms in many areas of law, with 9 offices in 5 states in the region. Some highlights of his more than 40-year career in law include past president of the Kentucky Bar Association, the Kentucky Bar Foundation, as well as his election to the UK Alumni Hall of Fame in 2004. He currently serves as the president of the American Bar Association. Mr. William Robinson.
Thank you very much. I am aware that there's a game somewhere this evening that may be of interest to some of you, so I will do my best to keep that in mind. I want to thank Lillian Dade, Chair of the Department of Government Law and International Affairs, Professor Tom Glover, to whom no one I've ever met could possibly say no, and certainly I could not when he graciously invited me to be here with you this evening, and Dr. Martin Battle for organizing this annual event at this outstanding institution, Murray State University. I am honored to be the speaker at this 35th annual Harry Lee Waterfield Lecture and to recognize and applaud his generosity to this university and this department. And I also would like to congratulate all the members of Pi Sigma Alpha and the scholarship winners this evening who have been recognized here and those who were recognized just before this event. All of you should be proud of your achievements and remember that this is just the beginning of your journey toward a successful and satisfying career in government, law, international affairs, or whatever field you choose. Each of you in this room, including these scholarship winners, as I said earlier this evening, have a unique contribution to make to this world. The educational foundation that you are laying in your undergraduate experience here at the university will set you on a course to make unique contributions in the future that no one other than you can make. And I hope you'll keep that in mind as you go forward. As president of the American Bar Association for the last 8 months, I have met with many students, many like you, around this country who are highly motivated, highly educated, and eager to engage in a dialogue about the future of our country. As I get closer and closer to 70 years of age, and I see the sun setting potentially on my career, hopefully not too soon, I see in you the future of this country, and I'm here to say that the future to me looks very bright. Considering my age and my experience, it is probably no surprise that I have a number of ideas about what we need to do to move our country forward, especially as it relates to the preservation of our constitutional democracy and promotion of the rule of law. But I also recognize that your generation will decide the next chapter of our nation's history. I say that knowing that I can work my BlackBerry pretty well for a guy my age, and only have to ask my sons every now and then to help me get through a problem on my iPad. But your generation never ceases to amaze me with your technological savviness and sophistication, never before seen, and ability to educate and effect real change in an instant via Twitter, Facebook, and other social media. I urge you to use this connectivity, that resourcefulness, and that power of communication for the good of the one safe place to resolve disputes and protect our rights. And of course, I'm speaking about our state courts. Our state judiciaries face a crisis never before seen in the history of this country. Chronic underfunding of our state courts combined with increasing caseloads is threatening to make them non-functional and possibly, eventually, irrelevant. As you know, our nation's founders specifically separated our government into 3 co-equal branches of government by design. to prevent the excessive accumulation of power by either the legislative branch, the executive branch, or the judicial branch. As a matter of clear constitutional mandate, the judiciary is one of three co-equal branches of government and needs to be funded accordingly. But it is not being treated as such. No state judiciary in this country receives more than 4% of its entire annual operating state budget. Not more than 4%. Some state court systems receive much less, even less in some states than an executive level department like a Department of Recreation. But as you know, financial times are tough and have never been tougher in my lifetime than they have been since 2007, 2008. Some state court systems are feeling the consequence of this. All state court systems are suffering because of this. And as you know, and you've read and you've come to learn, we're talking about a co-equal branch of our government. State and local legislators indeed have to make difficult choices when resources are less, when revenues are less. They have to entertain claims from schools, from parks, from roads, from all worthy recipients of money that they can allocate so that our socioeconomic environment continues to run successfully. But our courts are a priority and need to be treated as such. As Americans, we must ask ourselves some important questions. Is our commitment to our courts sufficient? Sufficient to guarantee a fair and timely legal process, sufficient to ensure the independence of our judiciary, and sufficient to instill a sense of confidence in our courts by the public at large. I would argue that currently our commitment is simply not enough. As you would expect, as a lawyer and officer of the court, I have come this evening with evidence to back up my argument. 95% of all cases filed in court in this country are filed in state courts. I was recently speaking in Utah, and I learned there that just in the state of Utah, not too dissimilar population-wise from Kentucky, there are more cases filed in a single year than in the entire federal court system in a single year. State courts process more than 100 million incoming trial court cases each year, and that's a number that is increasing every year. Something that is not increasing is the money spent to keep our courts running. Just last year, 2011, 42 states reduced funding for their judiciaries. In New York City, courts close at 4:30 p.m. every day with no exceptions. New York courts are trying to save time on overtime for bailiffs, air conditioning and heating, and other expenses following a $170 million court funding just this past year. In California, the courts have suffered more than $600 million in cuts in the last 4 years, $250 million of which were in the last 2 years. And in the Bay Area of San Francisco, just in the fall of 2011, 29 out of 63 courtrooms were closed and 40% of the court personnel laid off. In Morrow County, Ohio, a municipal court said no new lawsuits could be filed unless litigants brought their own paper and office supplies to the courthouse. 2 weeks later, donations of paper and office supplies poured in, but the court nevertheless is now closed on Fridays, every week, one day a week, because of limited funding. There are other more troubling examples that demonstrate how the law itself is being changed to meet this new financial reality for our state courts. Faced with a 10% budget cut, a district attorney's office in Shawnee County, Kansas, announced domestic violence cases would no longer be prosecuted. Then the Topeka City Council there voted to decriminalize misdemeanor domestic battery, also for budgetary reasons. That decision was reversed only after a public outcry. In January of this year, the Maryland Court of Appeals ruled that public defenders must appear at district court bail hearings to represent poor defendants who would otherwise be unrepresented. Rather than pay the annual $28 million cumulative cost to the state that would result from that ruling, Maryland simply, the legislature there, repealed the law that had invited the court challenge. Again, these are examples of how state and local governments are changing criminal law to fit budget realities. Simply put, if our legal system is not accessible, then it cannot be just and it will not be fair. But the impact is not simply on individual rights. Businesses throughout this country can suffer just as much from the unavailability of justice in our courts. Consider Florida's example. In 1998, voters in the Sunshine State amended their constitution to make the state responsible for funding parts of the court system. But when the recession hit and revenue fell, the state nevertheless cut its budget, and Florida's judicial system was forced to lay off staff and reduce operating hours. The Florida legislature then convened in 2009 to create a new funding mechanism for the courts, a trust fund made up of filing fees primarily from foreclosures. But the trust fund then did not generate the expected revenue legislators had planned for because foreclosures in the state dried up precipitously in the economic downturn for real estate in Florida. In early 2011, the Florida Supreme Court appealed directly to the legislature for a loan to close a $72 million shortfall. Lawmakers there more recently approved a new budget that did not cut the judiciary overall, but now court clerks face a $31 million cut that they say will undoubtedly delay civil cases. Florida's story is just one example that demonstrates the volatility of state court funding. Unless businesses have confidence that the judicial system will enforce contracts and resolve disputes in a timely way, companies will be less likely to take risks, such as expanding their operations and hiring new employees. In addition, corporations evaluate state judicial systems, among other things, when deciding to locate their corporate headquarters facilities and their plants. And if a corporation deems a court system too tumultuous, the community at large can suffer from loss of jobs and lost revenue. Without properly funded courts, we will undermine our country's economic recovery and the judiciary's constitutional mandate to provide access to justice for all Americans. So you have heard me cite the statistics, you have heard me share with you numerous examples, but what can be done about this? The courts are doing their part to demonstrate more and more efficiency and innovation. For example, you can follow the Philadelphia courts now on Facebook and Twitter and pay parking tickets, red light violations, and child support online. Iowa has implemented e-juror, which allows jurors to respond to summons and qualification questionnaires online. But courts themselves, without adequate funding, can only do so much. We must face reality, which many Americans do not understand. They do not understand, because of lack of civics education, what courts do and why courts are so fundamentally important to our way of life. That civic ignorance in the public arena could prove even more costly as we move forward. Courts must be open, available, and adequately staffed. No one would accept closing the local emergency room, or the local firehouse, or the local police station one day a week. Our justice system is no less important. And that is part of the message members of the legal community are using to highlight the financial needs of our state courts. Some are doing it creatively. In Massachusetts, where I recently visited, the Bar Association, at its own expense, has placed billboards along the interstates to bring the crisis in Massachusetts about funding and inadequate funding of the courts to the attention of the public. In California, a coalition of legal, business, and labor groups held a rally for needed court funding on the steps of a Los Angeles courthouse. The ABA, for example, has a national task force that is studying this issue and holding hearings to develop recommendations. Our most recent gathering on needed court funding held in New Orleans highlighted strategies to help win over legislators when it comes to court funding. But courts and bar associations can only do so much. We need a larger public education effort, one that encompasses not just students and academics, but the entire country. As Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has said, the better educated our citizens are, the better equipped they will be to preserve the system of government we have. Justice O'Connor is absolutely correct. We must articulate for our fellow citizens what courts do and why they are so essential by more effectively educating the general public, especially young people like you who are the future of our society. Greater civic knowledge and the public among the public at large will drive a renewed dedication to the preservation of our justice system. The evidence is compelling. Newsweek magazine recently polled Americans using the U.S. citizenship test. Almost 40% of those Americans failed the test. And yes, Americans did very poorly on the questions related to law and the legal system. Two-thirds, for example, did not know that our U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Frankly, voters across this country, and our polling continues to show this, are more likely to know the first and last names of every one of the judges on American Idol than to know even one name of a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, including the Chief Justice. And that is where you come in. We need you to help us get the message out that our courts are fundamental to our constitutional democracy. They are the one safe place for any American to go to resolve a dispute, seek protection, or hold government accountable under law. Whether you are fighting the foreclosure of your home, seeking custody of a child, or trying to resolve a business dispute, our courts must have sustainable funding to assure meaningful access to justice for all Americans. Let me leave you with this thought. An independent, adequately funded judiciary is the key to constitutional democracy. Constitutional democracy is the key to freedom. For more than 200 years, men and women in our country have sacrificed and died for this constitutionally protected freedom. The wise drafters of our Constitution were defined by the monuments they built, including our court system. Will your generation and mine be defined by our dedication to sustain our courts, or stand by and let them be destroyed? Let's stand up and speak out for one of our most precious monuments, our judiciary, as a place where all Americans receive the justice they deserve. Our liberty depends upon it. Thank you all very much.